collaboration between researchers at the National Institute on Deafness and Other Communication Disorders, the NIH, and a group called Justice Uniting Creative Energy, which is an LA-based nonprofit organization that provides training in hip-hop arts. So they actually had some hip-hop artists involved in the study, which I think is unique. The dance study did not include dancers in the study design, but in this case, two of JUICE's, that's the acronym for the Justice by Uniting Creative Energy, JUICE. So two of their directors participated in the study design and analysis. Michael W. Eagle, who's a hip-hop artist, and Daniel A. Rizik-Bear. So this paper offers an interesting example of a collaboration. In addition to being the director of JUICE, Mike Eagle especially is a well-known hip-hop performer. He performs under the name Open Mike Eagle, and he's recorded 6 albums. So in this study, experimenters asked 12 male freestyle artists to perform 2 different tasks in an fMRI. And as was the case with the dancers, the experimental setup demands that researchers prevent a conventional condition that differs from the test condition. So they had to impose something to freestyling. And so in this case, again, they relied on simply copying. So they had the hip-hop artist perform a set of memorized lyrics. So it's the same kind of rhetorical structure, I guess you could say, for this study as the previous one. So they were given the memorized lyrics ahead of time, and they used an 8-bar instrumental track. And then in the test condition, they freestyled over the same track. So it had the same rhythm. They're trying to control, obviously, for everything else. And then theoretically, you can just compare the two and say, well, this one's creative and this one's not. So you can probably see where I'm going with this. The memorized lyrics in the rap study functioned the same way as the waltz did in the dance study. So again, anyone who has performed and studied music would say that there's a certain amount of creativity in performing a memorized set of lyrics. Most performers do this all the time. And so again, we see the freestyle rap standing in as the synecdoche for creativity. So in this article, I want to draw attention just for a little bit to some of the wording used to see how this happens kind of at the textual level of the article. So. When they talk about creativity, they don't use a concrete categorical definition, but instead they use a series of synonyms and substitutions. So it's kind of fuzzy. So they start by saying freestyle rap, a popular form, requires an artist to freely improvise rhyming lyrics in novel rhythmic patterns guided by the instrumental beat. Dash, a particularly challenging form of spontaneous artistic creativity. So they're defining kind of by example there. So we're kind of swapping freely improvising rhythmic lyrics and novel rhythmic patterns with spontaneous artistic creativity. And then we're to agree that that demonstrates creativity rather than some other quality. And then they say further that the results of this study may generalize to other forms of spontaneous creative behavior. So we're to understand this spontaneous form of freestyling as similar to other spontaneous forms. So we have to accept the synecdoche, or in other words, we have to accept the reduction of creativity to the specific things being measured by this study in order to accept the logic of the article. So that's kind of just the rhetoric of how the article is working. So again, how might a rhetorical perspective enrich this kind of study and mitigate some of the effects of the kind of neuroessentialist or the reductive synecdochic argument that's being made? So again, we can point out that freestyling is not a pre-existing mental capacity. That's something that these people just have, but they've trained in much the same way and as rigorously as the dancers have to develop this. So in the study, they evaluated the freestyle rappers using this set of criteria. And so I'm assuming that that's part of where the rappers who were involved in the study helped with the study design. So they looked at things like, does it use humor? Do they avoid crutch phases like you know? Do they use multisyllabic rhyme schemes? So these are all things, these are part of the tools of the trade, things that freestyle artists develop over time through their training. So it's a lot like the modern dancer, really. So for one, many rappers describe how they use notebooks to keep track of their ideas for composition. So just like Twyla Tharp fills her box with all sorts of ideas for her choreography, in Decoded, Jay-Z describes how he would fill pages and pages of a spiral notebook with rhymes. In similar way, there's a 60 Minutes interview with Eminem where he displays one of his boxes of notes. He has these huge boxes just filled with all sorts of things scribbled on yellow legal pads. And he calls this stacking ammo. But as rhetoricians, we'd recognize this as a commonplace book. So these are, in rhetorical pedagogy, you'd be trained to keep a commonplace book full of ideas, quotes, snippets of ideas for a written composition. And you keep those, and then you refer back to them when you're stuck for ideas. So it's the exact same kind of process. Rappers train themselves to develop skill and rhythm and style. So in a Huffington Post interview, Open Mike Eagle, who's one of the study authors, noted that he'd been freestyling for 16 or 17 years, and there was a definite mastery arc, he said, involved in learning the craft. He explains that freestyling involves an understanding of meter, of where emphasis and stressed syllables should occur, and on different kinds of types of freestyle, or I guess different genres, as we would say. So he describes how some are more Dadaist in their approach. They just rap about whatever words come to mind, and they develop skill in that, being able to just draw on what's there. And then there's others who are always kind of thinking ahead, so they kind of know where they're trying to get to in the next couple bars of music, and they create a rough plan on the fly. So those are two different modes that he talked about. He said that when he was in the fMRI machine, they did some trial runs, and he found himself rapping about the fMRI itself. So you can see he's kind of in the first camp in a way. So just like the dancers learn a system of repeated steps that form part of a repertoire from which they can draw, so too do the hip-hop artists draw on a type of training that involves this repetition and rhythm and response. And just like dancing, it's an embodied activity. So when you're placing someone in an fMRI scanner, they can't really use their body in the same way that they would in a performance. So in the dance study, obviously, they had to get around this by having dancers imagine a dance rather than actually perform it. But in the hip-hop study, too, the Eagle explained that he had to get over his tendency to want to mark time with his body. So you know that if you watch a hip-hop artist perform, they're always trying, they're using their body as a metronome. And so he had to fight the urge to do that when he was in the fMRI. So reducing freestyling to creativity also ignores some of the more overtly rhetorical factors that are involved. So because it's a performance, it also draws upon word choice, which is something that we in the humanities study. In her book, Hip Hop Literacies, Elaine Richardson describes how hip hop artists develop, in her words, an orientation to their situated public role as performing products, and that their performances are connected to discourses of authenticity and resistance. So there's a discourse that they're drawing on, and some of the common themes that come up in hip hop music come out of this kind of common experience. In her book, Richardson provides a glossary of some of the terms that commonly appear in freestyle, each of which has a unique derivation and history of use. So for example, the term flow refers to the way that a rapper solidifies his or her vocals rhythmically and sonically within the track or the beat. So it's not just the more popular understanding of flow as being like a creative zone that you're in, but it has a very specific meaning. And when someone mentions flow in a rap, they're referencing a particular meaning of that term and drawing upon that term. So they need to draw on this extensive vocabulary that includes specific terms that are kind of unique to the subculture, so terms like crunked up, used to describe high energy or party atmosphere, bling, sparkly jewelry, and new uses of standard English terms, so the term crib references one's home or hood references neighborhood. But then in addition to these terms, they also draw on a wider vocabulary of, I guess, what we might consider mainstream English or even other languages. So many rappers freely admit to reading the dictionary, as nerdy as that sounds. And you can see evidence of this in their outcomes. So in his song Rap Protection Prayer, Eagle rhymes character with submariner and derringer, and the rhymes herringbone with pheromones and baritone. So you'll notice here that he has to decide what terms are close enough to rhyme in order to maintain the cadence of the passage. So they're not all exact rhymes, but they're close enough. Eminem is especially famous for this. So he's able to deliver rhymes by stressing different syllables. So even if they're not an exact rhyme, he can kind of sell it to an audience. There's a definite performance quality in what he does. So in a 60-minute video, he famously finds five rhymes for orange, the word that everyone says has no word that rhymes for it. So he says orange, four-inch, door hinge, and storage, and talks about having porridge with George. And so you can see how his stress on the different words allow us to understand them as rhymes. And he calls this bending the words to fit. So as was the case with the dancers, the rappers draw on a rich vocabulary from years of honing their craft. And that's the training that makes improvisation possible. And that includes things like imitation and copying. So I'm sure across the board, all of these freestylers started out by copying someone else's words and practicing them. So again, the patterns of brain activation that we recognize might not be creativity per se, but a mode of action in which participants draw on these habituated responses and trained capacities to produce something unique. Okay, so my third case is one involving creative writers. So this is a 2013 study, and it differs from the previous two in that it does not use experienced creative writers, but only used untrained individuals. And it says with no creative writing experience, but I can't believe that that's actually true because we all do at least some creative writing if we're educated, at least in this country. And I would say in most countries, we're, you know, the way we learn to write is usually by writing little stories when we start out, or little poems. So the study, again, replicates the rhetorical structure of the other two insofar as it relies on a fundamental contrast with an activity deemed creative, in this case, copying a text, once again, and one deemed creative. In this case, they gave them a passage from a text and had them continue it. So it was a start of a story that they then wrote another paragraph or two for. So they do this even though they say in the article that they doubt that the large spectrum of creative writing properties depends on a single mental ability. So even though they know this, they still do the same synecdoche, but we're going to let this thing stand in for creativity in this study. Note that the title of the article also closely parallels the other two. So we have neural correlates of creative writing, neural correlates of lyrical improvisation, and brain correlates underlying creative thinking. So that's another a commonality. And the title itself constitutes a claim. So the claim is that X, in this case creative writing, has neural correlates that can be defined in some way. So the imitative exercises given to creative writing students are similar to the ones that the dancers and the rappers would use. So it's pretty common in a creative writing class to be asked to rewrite a text, say, from the 18th century using contemporary language. Or you might compose a poem only using words and phrases found in another set of texts or something like that. Or you might replicate the form of a story while giving it a different set of a different content. So same form, but you change the characters and the setting or something like that. So all of these are mimetic activities, they're imitation, and they're part of learning to write creatively. And so then we can't call those things just uncreative and contrast them to creativity in the same way. So just like in the case of the dancers or in the case of the hip-hop artists, people who compose writing draw upon a wide range of resources. So part of this is even the setting in which they compose. And I guess in all of these studies, you have to abstract the setting out. So you can't have Twyla Tharp actually in her studio working with her collaborator. You have to have her in an fMRI machine or something like that. Writers are especially notorious for having really elaborate settings and rituals within which they write. So they have to have their cup of tea next to them, or they have to write on a yellow legal pad with a certain kind of pen, and they set up these rituals that allow them to be creative. So all of this is abstracted out of this type of study as well. So here again, a trained creative writer has a repertoire from which to draw. Even though in this case they're dealing with untrained writers, you can't not have some kind of repertoire if you're exposed to narrative, which we all are. So even if you don't read, you probably watch TV and you probably watch movies, and all of those have certain kinds of conventions. So you might draw on archetypical plots, like a journey motif or a quest motif, or certain kinds of characters, the hero and the villain. Or you might choose to flout those archetypes in a composition. So even if you're just a casual reader, you probably know something about how to tell a story using a plot and a setting and character. And it's likely that the readers, or the writers in this case, drew upon those, and I'll show that in a second. So in fact, in the supplementary materials provided with this article, they include a couple examples of texts composed by the participants. And then the first one, so the first part here is the line that they were given to continue, and in the second part you see how this writer continued it. So clearly this writer is drawing on the genre of comedy. So he describes how a man's violin was eaten by a donkey, and so he decided to play the comb instead. The second one, which I won't show you, is a writer who's clearly drawing on kind of a crime novel, So instead of doing a kind of comedic piece, he creates a narrative about a murder-suicide involving a man entering a laundromat and delivering items covered with his wife's blood, and then killing himself by sticking his head between the dryer coils. So to compose such a response, participants were likely drawing on previous genre knowledge, not just on creativity per se. They didn't come up with this stuff out of nowhere, but they took what they were given and decided, okay, maybe not even consciously, I'm going to do something comedic, or I'm going to draw on conventions of horror in order to finish my story. So just to wrap up, in my own field of rhetoric and composition, all of these studies are measuring what we call invention, which is the process of discovering ideas for composition. So I think the idea of invention can lend something to these kinds of studies. So while rhetoric is traditionally focused on composing oral or written arguments, it is notable that all three of the studies I've referenced here involved compositions of some sort, whether they were danced or rapped or written. In rhetorical theory, invention is a learned habit, one that may start out explicit, but it becomes more nuanced and more habituated and more automatic over time, so that a trained rhetorician, and I'm referring back to the ancient context in ancient Greece, a trained rhetorician was supposed to be able to deliver a beautiful composition, an oral speech, on any topic, just off the top of his or her head, just by drawing on this repertoire of rhetorical strategies and materials and techniques that they had developed. So I'd argue that it is this process of invention that's being measured in these neuroscience studies. Not creativity per se, but more specifically, the trained capacity to produce creative compositions. So invention refers to a systematic training process. In ancient Greece, they used this set of exercises called the progymnasmata, and it was meant to develop skill in generating and delivering arguments spontaneously. So one exercise called pattern practice would ask students to analyze the structure of a given sentence and then rewrite their own sentence using the original one as a model. So you use the same grammatical and rhetorical patterns, but just switch the content. And this is something we still ask our students to do in writing classes today. In Renaissance times, they would have done these exercises by translating from one language to another. So you'd work from Latin to English, or Greek to Latin to English, or something like that. So you'd also practice facility with this in different languages. Students would also keep commonplace books, which I mentioned, as a source of inspiration for their compositions. And all of these exercises give students a repertoire of linguistic strategies to draw on creatively when they compose something. W. Wasp Winterow wrote in a Quarterly Journal of Speech article that stylistic exercises enable, that is, mere exercises in style allow the student to internalize structures that make his own grammar a more flexible instrument for combining, and hence enable the student to take experience apart and put it together again in new ways, which is, after all, the generative function of language. So we can make the same argument by analogy, that the mere exercise in a waltz step, or the mere exercise in copying a passage, or the mere exercise of performing a memorized rap, enable in that sense. So they're not just a non-creative enterprise, they're the basis from which creativity can emerge. In addition, these studies ignore the training that goes into these domains, as I've said, and this has parallels too to ancient rhetorical pedagogy. So as Deborah Haughey describes it in her book, Bodily Arts, ancient study of rhetoric involved repetition, rhythm, and response, and these were bodily trained performances. So in fact, she describes how rhetoricians would train in the gym with the people doing gymnastics exercises, and they'd all be kind of like working out in a way, practicing their speeches as people were practicing physically with their bodies. So ballet dancers perform their pliés and jetés, rappers repeat their lyrics and practice them over and over again, creative writers practice certain poems and certain forms over again. So Shakespeare wrote 154 sonnets for this reason. Beethoven wrote, 120 sonatas or something. So they practice the same forms over and over again. So there's repetition and a form of kind of imitation within that that generates creativity. And finally, rhythm plays a role in all of these, too. So in the ancient gymnasium where the rhetoricians were practicing, they actually trained to an aulos, which was a kind of pipe-like reed instrument that would be marking a rhythm. And in the same way, Jay-Z describes how he would use his body to mark out the rhythm while rapping, banging on the table as he was practicing his raps. Dancers, of course, always have a rhythm, whether it's music or just the dance teacher clapping out a tempo, or an internalized 5, 6, 7, 8 in your head. And even language, so even the creative writers, there's a rhythm to words, especially in poetry, but even in prose, there's a kind of rhythmic aspect to what is being done there. So all of those elements are acknowledged in these studies, but they're kind of background. So you'll notice that in the dance study and in the hip-hop study, they're given a beat, but it's just kind of a background track. It's not seen as integral to what it is that they're proposing. It's something that can be neutralized and kind of abstracted out. One more thing that we can learn from rhetoric in these studies is the idea of kairos. So that's the idea of timing. Pahi refers to kairos as a kind of imminent, rhythmic, embodied practice. So it's the idea that you create these compositions in a particular moment. And you can do so when you've been trained to draw on this repertoire. So in the way that a trained writing machine can deliver an extemporaneous speech, a hip-hop artist can deliver in the moment a freestyle composition. And there's something about the time itself that is important to that. So especially if you're delivering, if they're freestyling in a club where there's the atmosphere of the people around and the kind of energy that you feed off of that, you can't measure any of that in a study where you're in an fMRI scanner. So that too kind of gets abstracted out. But that's part of the creativity, being able to sense the right moment to deliver the right kind of line just at the right time. And so finally, we would argue that from a rhetorical perspective, what's creative is not just defined based on a set of criteria, but by the reaction of an audience. In 1953, Morris I. Stein defined a creative work as a novel work that is accepted as tenable or useful or satisfying by a group in some point in time. And if you're familiar with the research on creativity, the first part of that definition is still cited all the time, but they dropped the second part out. So the by a group in some point in time is abstracted out of that. But this is the last part that interests us as rhetoricians especially. That's audience and kairos, a group in time. So according to Stein, in creative arts, it's the patron or the critic, and perhaps also the population at large, that determines whether a creative work is tenable or useful or satisfying. So in these neuroscientist studies, the rhetorical context changes so that the composers are producing their compositions for an audience of researchers. I mean, that's kind of their rhetorical situation, not in front of an audience who's actually going to appreciate and evaluate that aside from some kind of study. So I hope I've shown how a humanistic perspective, and especially a rhetorical perspective, can enrich neuroscience studies of creativity. So I come as a friend who would like to, you know, help out a little with some of the problems that I identified at the start of my talk. So I think there's a need there that can benefit from a humanistic perspective. So part of my argument is that the experimental designs required for certain kinds of research, especially fMRI type of research, actually necessitates or at least encourages some of this reification and reduction in order to produce evidence within that paradigm. But my hope here is that a humanities perspective, and especially a rhetorical perspective, can enrich those studies and complicate our assumptions about what is being measured and how we can measure it, and identify other factors that must be taken into consideration in order to produce better evidence. Thank you.
So we have a little bit of time for questions. If you need to take off, please feel free to. That's part of it. A lot of you have other places to go. You want a stool?
I'll just come out for
a while. I'll let you. Yeah, if you have questions or comments.
So I guess one thing I've been thinking about as you talk about these two different cases is one way to interpret all of what you're saying is that when we're dealing with something complex like creativity, we need to be really careful about what our control conditions actually allow us to conclude. Right? If we're trying to say there's a difference between this group and that group, or this condition and that condition, what does that comparison really let us conclude? Mm-hmm. And I feel like this is something that does happen during the peer review process. Like these are discussions that probably happen during the review of these papers. Do you feel like the rhetorical perspective offers something different than the kind of discussion that is probably happening within neuroscience? Or do you feel like it's very much the same kind of discussion?
Well, I don't know about those discussions because I don't, you know, peer review these articles. So it's interesting that you mentioned that it probably came up, but then what happens? So why doesn't it get, is it just kind of acknowledged and...
You have to have a control. You have to
compare.
Well,
you do, right.
Yeah.
And there's also negotiation about whether this control lets you say the thing you're trying to say, I guess. But I'm just thinking that, you know, on one hand, because this is, because creativity is very much a humanistic pursuit, it seems that there's lots of room to say, hey, there's good ideas about the control conditional.
Right.
And I guess I'm wondering if you feel like in something that is not a humanistic pursuit, or at least not as obviously one, would a rhetorical analysis like this have the same kind of contribution?
Yeah, so, like, I don't want to make it seem like I'm this rhetorist, you could just waltz in and say, here's how to make all these studies better. So the things that I'm focusing on are ones where I read them and I say, okay, that resonates with something that we do. So we study creativity, we study composing, and we study invention. Here's our perspective, and, you know, take it or leave it. Like, I don't, you know, it's not for me to say this study could be done differently, but I think it would be worth thinking through. What would it mean to be more fine-grained in terms of how we're defining copying as something that's not creative? So is that the best control condition, or is there something else that you could come up with besides copying that would create the contrast you're trying to create? And then would you call that creativity, or would you call it, like, I actually would be fine with this study if they didn't say this is creativity, but if you said this is improvisation versus performing a memorized piece, like, fine by me, because that's, to me, that's a more accurate description of what it is, really. So, I mean, that's maybe a pretty minor insight. But I think if the field is concerned about the fact that creativity seems to be this nebulous construct, then a humanities perspective might help to kind of tailor that concept down, right? Say, what are the different components of creativity that we might... So there's improvising, but there's also training, there's, you know, the audience, there's timing, there's all these other factors that go into it. And so if a humanistic perspective could help with that, I think that would be great.
A minute ago you said something like, so you can take it or leave it. And I was just wondering, is anyone taking it?
Yeah. Well, so I'm working with neuroscientists now on a project, and it's different from this, but this is, they've kind of helped me think about this project. And I kind of feel like the project that we have might eventually get there, but it's kind of a meta-analysis project right now, and what we're looking at is what are the most common terms that emerge in neuroscience research? It's a corpus analysis project. So we're starting by mapping them out. So we're looking at creativity, memory, attention. We did a 10-year sweep of fMRI studies, and then we're pulling out, using different discourse analytic tools, what are the concepts that come out most, and what brain regions are they linked to? So we're using social network analysis for that. And then our plan is to do, from there, choose some areas that especially interest us. So where are there kind of like clusters of terms that seem interesting from a rhetorical perspective, and we're going to kind of drill down. So we're kind of at an early stage, but I'm hoping that by me doing this research, I'll have a better perspective when we come time to like select particular clusters, I guess, of that social network and see how they're working.
It did strike me, as Ben was suggesting, that that picking creativity was a good one for you to pick on, not only because it fits some of what you do, but also because I think it's a particularly difficult concept for these guys to follow.
Right.
And so as you were talking, it, you know, just occurred to me that what we think of a lot of times, we think of a construct called creativity, and then what we do is we operationalize it in a bunch of different ways. And in any one study, I would hope that the authors would sort of apologize in the discussion and say, you know, this is one way we've operationalized it, but it's limited because it also includes these other things which you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Although I suspect that perhaps in these cases, these authors weren't doing that in discussion, and that's where you think, you know, your analysis would add, I think, for them to think about the other ones they need to apologize for this one operationalization. But then, of course, it's the process works over time.
Right.
And once we accumulate a dozen of these, if they all point to the same thing, even though we have all these different operationalizations, it allows you to start to feel better about calling it.
Mm-hmm. I guess, so we had a lunch today where we were talking across disciplines between some graduate students in English and some in psychology, and I don't know if the one guy is here, but he said something like, I felt really uncomfortable the way you were talking about this until you talked about like one specific variable, because that's how psychology works. So I guess that's part of my point too, is that like some of these things that are problems are part of how you do research in this field. Like you have to identify one thing that you can contrast a viewer between a control and a test condition. And then in the humanities, we want to think holistically. So we want to say, well, it's this and this, and there's so many variables that you just can't measure it. We just kind of throw up our hands and say, you know, instead let's have concepts that we can use to just kind of theorize it. So it is a very different kind of language game, I guess, that we're in these different fields.
Okay.